Welcome to Books and Beyond with your host, Alison. Join us for half an hour of information, entertainment, reading recommendations, and beyond. Brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
I know this girl, and she works in a library, yeah.
No mai, haere mai, kia ora. Welcome to Books and Beyond. This is your host, Alison, and today Karen joins me again in the studio. Kia ora, Karen.
Kia ora, Alison.
So last week, in the program that we did about train travel, we said that fiction set on trains was much more romantic than that set on planes. But then once we were off the air, we suddenly realised that there is, of course, one author who has managed to romanticise air travel, and that is Joan Didion. And we both happen to be Joan fangirls. So how did we not remember that last week?
I don't know. I think it might have just been we were so taken by the silver bullet trains that it completely blocked out the silver bird in the sky.
Yeah.
And, yeah, the scene in particular, I think her maximum scene, although there's many references to air travel, but in particular, it's her description of that plane flight across the Pacific in her novel Democracy, which is set in the 70s, for those who haven't read it, at the end of the Vietnam War. And in this scene, a U.S. senator's wife, who has just walked out on her husband, and her CIA agent lover, as odd as that may sound, are flying out of Honolulu together to look for her daughter, who's gone missing in Vietnam. And here's how it goes. For those of you who are new to Joan Didion, enjoy the Didion sentences, which is how Jack Lovett and Inez Victor happened that Easter Sunday night in 1975 to take the Singapore Airlines flight that leaves Honolulu at 3:45 a.m. and at 9:40 a.m. one day later lands at Kai Tak, Hong Kong. Recently, when I took this flight, I thought of Inez, who described it as an 11-hour dawn. Inez said she never closed her eyes. Inez said she could still feel the cold of the window against her cheek. Inez said the 3:45 flight from Honolulu to Hong Kong was exactly the way she hoped dying would be. Dawn all the way.
That's just beautiful, isn't it? Yeah, and it's really brings back memories for me, because I remember as a child travelling on the Honolulu run down to Auckland on the DC-8 and the DC-10, that showing my age here, but because I was a flight engineer's daughter, and I'll my memories of it are wearing my best clothes ever and having to be on my absolute best behaviour, but then having the chance to go up into the cockpit and see Dad and see the captain, and the captain might do something like tip their wings just to show what it felt like.
Their wings not being the little pin on their jacket.
Yeah, that's right.
Not the wings you get pinned with, the wings of the airplane.
The big bird.
I like the way you could see your flight engineer's daughter, but you referred to the wings of the airplane as their wings.
Their wings.
Would tip their wings.
Yes, I'll always be a flight engineer's daughter, I'm sure. And then handing out the lollies at the end, being allowed to do that. So I'm sure they were all breaches of health and safety laws back in the day.
I think, don't airlines have their own laws?
Are they? They might. Yes. But this, of course, was all pre-9/11. So it was a different era.
But you do remember that when you're a little kid, the sleeping on the plane.
Yeah. And that the drone of the turbine engines. And yeah, and I'll always remember that feeling of the cold window, the cabin window against my cheek, and watching the endless dawn as well.
Yeah, because there was it Honolulu, wasn't it? They were flying, yeah. So, that thing about remembering, I actually have a feeling that I have my most vivid flight memory in some way encompasses my Joan Didion experience that I had already read this description on a plane, among other things. I read Democracy on an airplane. My sister had given it to me to read on a flight to Europe. But the most vivid experience I've ever had on an airplane is when I was flying from New Zealand to California to visit my mother, who was terminally ill at the time, and we had a stopover in Tahiti. So we arrived at night, and there was this incredibly long approach into Papeete over the lagoon, where the pilots cut out the engines completely, which was later explained to me that it's something to do with protecting the animal life in the lagoon. And we just kept skimming effortlessly over the surface of this black water, of this still, totally still black water, reflecting back the moon at us. It was a moonlit night. And I remember thinking, it seemed to last forever. And I remember thinking that I hoped that my mother's death would be like that, just skimming this dark lagoon and then peacefully finally touching down.
Oh, that brings a tear to my eye. And yeah, that feeling of just gliding, gliding in. Gliding somewhere.
The bird, the steel bird, but also glides,
Oh, it's wonderful, isn't it? And because all of this has given us a real desire to jones on Joan today. In fact, I've been jonesing all week for some Joan time.
Yes, it did get us excited about Joan. Who'd been thinking about Joan recently?
That's right.
Like, Joan's always with us.
Yeah, she is, yeah.
Well, I it's funny that it would be someone I was thinking in this course of this week, how funny it is that it would be someone who's known for being skeptical and grounded, if I may make a little pun, rather than romantic, as Joan Didion is, who would be the one to romanticize air travel. But then I think Joan has always been surprising.
Yeah,
am I right?
I think so, yes.
And while she definitely has a sentimental side, which in my memory comes out mostly in her writings on her California childhood, or possibly I'm attuned to them having had a childhood in California myself, she's more known for her cynicism, I think skepticism maybe, and a certain terseness, which she would probably attribute to her migraineous personality. If anyone suffers from migraines, you have to read her essays on migraines. I know that I'm not, don't come across as terse necessarily, although I suffer from migraines, but when I'm having them, I am terse. And when she talks about people once upon a time, not specifically her forebears crossing the mountains into California, but at other times definitely, as being people who displayed a certain toughness, a kind of moral nerve, she could be talking about herself, don't you think?
Yeah, no, definitely. And because she comes across as tough sometimes, but also tender. So there's that dichotomy, I guess, that she displays. Yeah. And because really Joan is such an icon, isn't she? And I guess like all icons, she just has hundreds of imitators.
Well, they do say, I can't remember, I think it was Megan Daum who pointed out, who's a great essayist also, who pointed out that all young women essayists, particularly if they're thin, what did she say? Particularly if they're thin and something else, wear sunglasses or something.
Yes, those giants.
Will write like Joan in their earliest essays. I've got hundreds of blog posts and things where I've got a definite Joan tone.
Yeah. And because your Joan tone, I guess we could call that Didion-esque.
Yes, definitely, Didion-esque.
But then, so that makes me think, what is it that qualifies a writer to have esque after their name?
Joan being in the pantheon of those writers who do have the esque, like the Kafka-esque, I suppose, would be the most famous.
Yeah, and because I'm thinking, even with the musicians who are also poets, the Springsteen-esque and Dylan-esque, there's so many of them. How does a writer become an adjective?
Well, I think it could be, so one is if you're feeling like you're in a scene, so the Kafka-esque that I offered earlier would be, it feels like I'm in a scene from a novel by Kafka. It's not referring to Kafka who worked in an insurance agency and lived with his parents. It's referring to a scene in one of his novels. And that would be similar to, another one could be Pinter-esque, if you're like in a play by Harold Pinter. But then I think the Joan, the Didion-esque applies more to the other thing, which would be, in the style of. So that's like a Hemingway-esque, people who are authors who are identified as much with their style, their lifestyle, or the style with which they live their lives, which is very different.
So is that like a sophistication?
In the case of Joan, yeah, not Hemingway.
Yeah, no. So I'm getting back to Joan.
Sophisticated, cool, collected, migrainous.
And I had thought cynical, but then you were thinking perhaps more skeptical.
Yeah.
Better.
I think the thing about, when I say collected, the thing about Joan Didion is that she's always very careful not to go for extremes. She's skeptical about going for extremes. So rather than being purely cynical, she'll just put something out there to plant the doubt. I remember, in particular, the essays that she wrote on the New York jogger case. This was a jogger with a five black young men, teenagers, were put in prison for, were convicted of having raped her in Central Park, and it wasn't them at all. And Joan Didion is one of the few authors, one of the few journalists in America to have noted in her articles on the case that there was no physical evidence tying these boys to the case. She was always very careful to, it was an intellectual rigor. There was no hedging, no convenience, no making your piece arrive at the ending that you wanted it to have.
It really intelligent writing, isn't
it? Not to say she couldn't be sarcastic at times.
Yeah, and quite biting too.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, mordant. Yeah, yeah. A bit cryptic.
Cryptic. Yep, and that real dry wit too.
Oh, definitely humor. That. Yes, humor and wit, and also this sharp eye.
Yes, yeah.
Which at times has been called surgical.
Surgical, yes, the surgical eye. And, of course, you alluded to the style in which she lived her life.
I noticed you picked that up. Yes, you started to say lifestyle.
I'll change it. But I can't forget those pictures of her in her big sunglasses standing by the Corvette.
Right.
That she drove.
Yeah. There's a Celine ad, too, where she's wearing her big... is it a Celine ad and she's wearing Dior sunglasses, or a Celine sunglasses and a Dior ad? I'm not up on my brands, but that's a famous one that I've... it definitely captures that zone, the zone of Joan.
Yeah, the Joan zone.
She does have a great name, doesn't she?
Oh, yeah.
So, the driving a Corvette, like as you just said, of all the cars, a Corvette. Yeah. That's so cool.
Absolutely. And, you know, even the photos of her smoking, even though that's...
All the photos of her,
yeah,
I believe.
Yeah, because they're all, yes.
Often with a gin glass in the other hand.
Yes, a drink and a cigarette, which is totally not cool anymore. So don't try this at home. But even they still look cool when you see those photos.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're so iconic, aren't they? Yeah.
I think there's something also about the coolness of Joan that is related to this, that has an effect on the way she shares information that makes it such a Joan way of sharing information, which is these sort of tossed off comments. And you can see with someone waving a cigarette in their hand as they speak. In interviews, she's admitted to polishing her writing for hours. This actually comes out in a discussion of being whether or not she's a migrainous personality, and she talks about being a perfectionist. But when you read them, they're just two or three idiosyncratic details which she puts out there for you, and then you have to put them together to make the picture of what your how you absorb it. It's your personal picture.
Yeah. And do you notice how she inserts herself into the narratives?
Yeah, it's part of that being personal. Yeah, exactly.
So I guess, is that where the personal essay comes from?
Yeah, she's always got this dialogue where she's saying things like, you will have perceived, both in her novels and her essays, you will have perceived by now that, or let me go further. I did not know why I did or did not do anything at all. That's one of my favorites. That's so Joan. It's another one that imitators will often do, which is that give you the choice. You know, it's A or B, and I'm not going to tell you which.
And you can choose.
And you can choose.
Yeah.
What does that suggest? You tell me. I think that's in Democracy, where she says, what does this suggest? It is. It's about Inez running off with Jack. And she says, it's very, very, very biting, because she points out that when Inez got on the 11-hour plane, dawn plane flight, she actually had a ticket. And so what does that tell us? You tell me.
And so her book's almost they become a dialogue, don't they?
Yeah, they're very, it's you and the reader, she and the reader. I suppose, what were you saying about the personal, did you say personal essay?
Yeah.
Did you mention that?
Yeah.
I wonder, before Joan, were they called personal essays? She might actually be the inventor of the personal essay. I didn't study up on that.
No, well, maybe we're right. You heard it here first, I guess, which is great. So Joan, the Joan Zone, it's too big really to fit into a 30-minute show. So we had thought that what we could do is, for the next part of the show, to play the Didion Genius sentence game.
So this is to show off Joan's loaded sentences.
Yeah, the loaded, yes. And because we think she may have invented the loaded sentence.
Yeah, I have a feeling I'm going to say the real inventor would be Emily Dickinson.
Yes.
I'm going to allow myself, said, referred to her life as a loaded gun. Emily Dickinson had very loaded sentences, but they were also, it was poetry, so it's a different thing. All poets actually have loaded sentences. But I think in the terms of bringing that into the essay and the novel, absolutely, Joan was a master. So virtuosity is another thing.
Yes.
So for a loaded sentence, I've actually picked, so we've each picked a couple of examples. So possibly my favorite is from a journalistic piece that she wrote called Lifestyles in the Golden Land being California. And the sentence is, a coronet of seed pearls held her illusion veil. And now I'm going to explain to you why that's loaded. You might go, what's loaded about that, Karen? So this is actually a line that I've chosen to celebrate Didion's signature light but steely irony. So this piece of journalism was inspired by a true crime article in the news, but takes us somewhere else altogether, into social commentary, a bit of Dostoevsky, depravity in the heart of man. And it's the story of a murder in the San Bernardino Valley in Southern California, which is a very ominous place, a desert, hostile sort of place settled by religious fundamentalists. And it's a James M. Cain type story, as Didion tells us. So Lucille murders her boring Seventh-day Adventist dentist husband to get his life insurance money and start a new life with the suave lawyer she's having an affair with. There's also definitely a bit of Madame Bovary here.
Yes.
Whose wife had conveniently also recently died on a night that Lucille had been visiting. So the suave lawyer throws Lucille under the bus when she gets arrested. The true depravity being, and I think Joan makes this quite clear, being not in the heart of the murderer, but in the heart of the man who led her along and profited by it until it got out of control. And so then she's found guilty and gets sent off to prison. And he marries his children's Swedish nanny, who at the wedding wears a long white silk dress and a coronet of seed pearls held her illusion veil.
Isn't that so well done?
Loaded.
It's very loaded, isn't it?
But you can see she's also done her research. I wouldn't have even known there's a kind of veil called an illusion veil, would you?
No. And when I'd read that, I was trying to think of old wedding photos. And I was thinking, what is an illusion? But then the veil is an illusion too, isn't it? But it's so loaded, isn't it? I really do love that.
So let's hear yours.
Well, my one is from her essay on morality, which was written in 1965. And I'm not sure if this is one sentence or two. Oh, no, I think it is one, because I've broken some of the rules here. I do apologise for that. So this one, it goes like this. For better or worse, we are what we learned as children. My own childhood was illuminated by graphic litanies of the grief awaiting those who failed in their loyalties to each other.
Mm.
Gee, I related to that. All of those cautionary tales that we were brought up with, and which somehow then shape your own morality. Yeah, did you find that that sort of resonated with you?
Yeah, she has this great part. So the part that really resonated with me is, I think it's, isn't it in Morality, she talks about the Donner Party.
Oh, yes.
How they, Donner Party being the pioneers who left, who got lost and got back on the trail and then ended up a little too late in the season trying to cross the mountains into California and getting trapped by the snow in the mountains with not enough food and ended up having to eat their dead, but that they kept a morality, which was you never ate your relatives, your own blood relatives.
Yes. Yeah. Gee, that's really loaded and graphic too, isn't it?
You've got another post-it there. Was that another sentence?
And then
I was going
to do another one as well.
No, you had another sentence from the same paragraph, same essay.
Yeah, it's from the essay. Yeah, it's just over the page. So now, where are we? Oh, okay. Now, this is also on morality. I like this one. You see, I want to be quite obstinate about insisting that we have no way of knowing beyond that fundamental loyalty to the social code of what is right and what is wrong, what is good and what is evil. I dwell so upon this because the most disturbing aspect of morality seems to be the frequency with which the word now appears in the press, on television, in the most perfunctory kinds of conversation. And doesn't that apply to today? And, you know, this was written in 1965.
I sometimes, you know, rereading Didion in preparation for this show, I did see at times why she was so perfect for the 60s, and which is when she, you know, wrote the most iconic, let's say, I hate that word, of her pieces, because it was a time where there was an overload of idealism and of rage, and so her very collected, skeptical way of reporting on this was a great balance to that, whereas now, in this time of neoliberalism, calculation, incremental change, we feel we really do need idealism and rage, and so I think there's a different kind of writing happening now, which is really of our times, which is the book like the one I'm reading now, Good and Mad by Rebecca Traister.
Oh.
It's hard to picture Joan Didion writing a book called Good and Mad, isn't it?
It is.
Also because her parents probably would have told her that you don't say mad, you say angry, the way my parents used to say to me. But anyway, back to Joan's loaded sentences. So I've got another one that I love, which is from an essay of hers called On Keeping a Notebook. And this one is, I think we are well advised to keep on nodding terms with the people we used to be, whether we find them attractive company or not. Mm. And I really like this for the Didion-esque use of or not, you know, that same Didion thing of giving you the two alternatives. But anyway, this is an essay. I also like it because it's on an essay on compulsion, which is a compulsion which I share, which is the compulsion to write things down. And she describes it as a compulsion which is inexplicable to those who do not share it, useful only accidentally, only secondarily, in the way that any compulsion tries to justify itself. But she makes it clear that it's not about having a factual record of what she's been doing. It's not a diary. She said she's always failed at diaries, same way I've always failed at diaries. Do you keep a diary, Alison?
No, I failed.
Yeah, we all fail. But she says, it's not a record of what she's been doing or thinking, and then she calls it, she says, that would be an impulse for reality, which I sometimes envy but do not possess. But instead, she says, what she scribbles down are what some people would call lies, which is, well, maybe it didn't happen that way, but that's how it felt to me.
Mm.
And so she's got this wonderful, you've led the way by putting two sentences so I'm going to add another sentence. I was hard put to choose between the two sentences I loved in Keeping a Notebook. So one of the things when she talks about looking back at her notebook and she sees a recipe for sauerkraut in her notebook, and then she says, this is actually how the essay ends, I was on Fire Island when I first made that sauerkraut, and it was raining, and we drank a lot of bourbon and ate the sauerkraut and went to bed, and I listened to the rain and the Atlantic. It felt safe. I made the sauerkraut again last night, and it did not make me feel any safer, but that is, as they say, another story. Mm. Very Didion.
Yes, yeah. It is.
Another story.
Yes.
That's another story.
Yeah. So maybe it was the bourbon or the sound of the Atlantic that made her feel safe. Who knows?
Or the person she was with.
Yes.
She doesn't mention. She also leaves things out, which is a very Didion-esque thing.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, geez, she's so good, isn't she? So I guess I could, well, speaking of breaking the rules, I have my next sentence. It's actually three sentences.
Go for it.
I'm not sure that I'm allowed to do this, but
No. We've made our way there.
Yes, my morality says that I can do three sentences. And this one is about self-respect. From an essay of hers also, 1961.
One of her most famous essays, an essay.
That's right. So where is she? So self-respect is a discipline, etc. So it was once suggested to me that as an antidote to crying, I put my head in a paper bag. As it happens, there is a sound physiological reason for this, something to do with oxygen, and for doing exactly that. But the psychological effect alone is incalculable. It is difficult in the extreme to continue fancying oneself as Kathy in Wuthering Heights with one's head in a food fear bag. It just makes me kind of, you know, laugh and cry.
Yeah.
At the same time, it's that,
once again,
the dichotomy, the, you know, imagine, well, we've probably all been told this, oh dear, you're upset, just put your head in a paper bag.
I've never been told that.
but
I think I would guess, my guess would be, is the incongruity of it, she says there's a sound science.
Yes.
You're a chemist, what's the sound
yes.
scientific reason?
Oh, it's all to do with acid and base, so you've got to try and get the pH.
More carbon dioxide.
Yeah, well, less, I think, but, don't judge my chemistry. It's to do with the pH. Definitely very sound reasoning, but it just, something about it doesn't fit, does it?
And that's the one where she also has that wonderful line about lying down in bed, that we eventually lie down alone in that notoriously uncomfortable bed, the one we make ourselves. Mm. And hang on, I've got it here. Whether or not we sleep in it depends, of course, on whether or not we respect ourselves.
Oh, it's wonderful, isn't it? That whole self-respect.
Yeah, I think that's something that could be assigned in school.
That essay.
And it's also, it's very Joan, because it's got that thing where she says, people with self-respect exhibit a certain toughness, a kind of moral nerve. They display what was once called character, a quality which, although approved in the abstract, sometimes loses ground to other, more instantly negotiable virtues. Now, that's definitely a thing of our times.
Yes. Oh, this essay, it's wonderful, isn't it? I think it should be required reading.
So if people, let's remember to tell everybody, why don't I just tell them right now?
Yeah.
That if you want to see all of Joan Didion's essays together and her journalism, there's a wonderful collection, which is called, a wonderful quote from Joan Didion, "We Tell Ourselves Stories in Order to Live," put out by Everyman's Library.
Yeah, and we do, don't we? We tell ourselves story, and we have a narrative about our lives.
That's right.
Yeah. It's, I've enjoyed being in the Joan zone today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we can get people to send us messages on what other authors they would like us to fangirl about.
Yes, yeah. So, yeah.
How would they do that? They would comment on the Auckland Library's blog.
Yeah, so they could contact us via our blog, which is on the Auckland Library's website, aucklandlibraries.govt.nz. I guess they could always contact us here through Planet FM too, Planet Audio.
But if they go on the blog, they'll see the list of all the books that we've talked about.
Yes, that's right. So, and look, we'd love to get some suggestions about who to fangirl next.
It might even be an author we've never read, and we'd have to have a week to
to do some
to hit the decks.
Some pretty full-on research, but we'd be happy to do that, wouldn't we? Yeah, so this has been a great effort, I would say. I was just going to say that rugby was the winner on the day, which I guess it kind of has been this week.
You've lost me completely.
Yes.
Who won what in rugby?
Yes,
what did I not know?
It was a game of two halves, as they say. But rugby was the winner in the end. So that's just a you know, a nod to the week's triumphs and tragedies on the field. So perhaps on that note, I should say farewell. Until next week, happy reading.
And try some Joan Didion.
Yes,
if you haven't already.
I'm going to keep joaning, I think, for a day or so. So, haere rā.
Haere rā.
And ka kite anō.
Brought to you by Auckland Libraries. Find us online at aucklandlibraries.govt.nz and catch the program next Sunday at 9:35 p.m. on 104.6 FM or anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/booksandbeyond. Every day.